Osiris.
Hey everybody, this is the Helping Friendly Podcast. This is a quick hit of the last two nights of the Madison Square Garden run. The first quick hit of 2019, talking about the last shows of 2018. It's really confusing, but I'm here with Matt, one of our co-hosts. Hi, Matt.
Hey, man. How's it going?
Good. And we have a guest, Dan, who's here, who I think is a listener. Dan, we appreciate your support and reaching out, and glad you were able to join us here.
I am a listener. Thanks for having me. Excited to talk to you guys.
And Dan, you got to see all four nights, and you're probably pretty exhausted at this point, but full of love for fish.
I am, and I'm feeling like exactly the way you would expect after a four-night fish run, which is starting to get sick, and my serotonin levels are significantly depleted. But no, it was a great time.
And we're going to talk a little bit about the 30th and 31st. Hopefully people saw we did a couch report at Relics on the 29th with Tom and the Dude of Life and Mike Greenhouse from Relics. So we'll put a link to that video in the notes if you guys haven't seen it. It was really fun. Tom and the Dude played an original song that they wrote for Trey, which is pretty entertaining. And we talked about the 28th and 29th on the last episode. So we can focus on the 30th here. That was the last night of the run that I saw. To me, I'll just throw this out there. The first set felt like a pretty crazy second set in a lot of ways. I don't know, Matt, if you want to start, and then we can throw it over to Dan.
Yeah, I know. So I only saw the 30th and 31st and was hoping that the momentum that they had going from that amazing show on the 29th was going to carry through to Sunday night's show. And it definitely did. I think I ran in, I guess that was the set break when I saw you in the hallway. And I think between the two of us, we could barely formulate a complete sentence about how amazing it was. I think it's one of those things where, like, if you could take like the second set of the night before and the first set of this one, it's like the perfect show. Two really amazing sets. And I had such a good time during that set. If the show had been over at that point, I would have felt completely satisfied. I mean, it really felt like there was not much more that they could do after what you described accurately as a pretty killer second set played too early in the night.
Yeah, Dan, did you feel the same way about the 30th, and what were some of your highlights from the first set?
I completely agree, especially coming off the 29th, which I thought was probably ended up being the best show of the run, in my opinion, although it's close to the 30th. But the first set was just, it was just relentless, and it was just really fun throughout. Going into a show, I feel like this is exactly the sort of thing that you want to see, like, you know, an unexpected opener, and then, you know, just the mics in that, you know, second, third spot right there. Just, you know, really, I think, matched the intensity of the crowd. And it was just relentless too. I mean, to go from Week Apart to Cross-Eyed and Painless, 45 minutes or maybe not even into the show that's about as good as it gets in terms of starting out.
Yeah, that I was going to ask you, Matt, about the Week Apart when they went back into it from Tube. I was sitting behind the stage and I didn't see any signals or anything. It felt like they just went back into it, just kind of feeling it. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it seemed pretty organic, and I think it continued the trend that we've had since the fall of really, really great versions of Tube that finally have started to get out there a little bit. They were definitely doing some pretty good jamming and got into that Week Apart groove pretty naturally. I thought even better was actually the transition back into Tube, because it felt like they were sort of coming to like the natural ending of Week Apart and got it pretty seamlessly back into Tube. But it's amazing, like, when you look at this set, I mean, the fact that they opened up with Alumni Blues almost gets skipped over in favor of, like, all of the other amazing things that happened during the set. Of course, when you've got, you know, a song that's played for the second time only ever 23 years after its debut in Glide 2, and then Bliss, which, like, I don't know about you guys, I always forget that they had never even played that live before.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was the whole thing by that point. I mean, even before the Tube in Week Apart Sandwich, you know, it felt like they could do no wrong by that point. And I have to echo what you guys said, is like the energy of the crowd from the start of the show and through that entire first set was just off the charts.
Yeah, it's interesting. And my wife, I was trying to explain to her why it was a big deal that they played Glide 2, and she was like, the song's kind of slow and boring, but like everyone was going nuts. And I'm like, well, it's just for like statistical purposes. And she's like, wow, this is weird. But it wasn't. that's how it goes, right? Dan, what were your second set highlights, your thoughts on the second set of 12:30?
So I thought the second set was actually really an interesting set, the way they put it together. I mean, obviously we had the first or the second Cool Amber and Mercury, but I really enjoyed Everything's Right. Sort of the end of that jam was really, really good. And you know, the Plasma was also a treat too, something you don't get too often. And I thought it was really well played. And then, you know, Light was really, really significant to me. I mean, it peaked twice, once in like the first 10 minutes and then again at the end. And, obviously Velvet Sea is going to be a divisive song choice pretty much at any time. But I actually thought that the segue into it, the transition was actually really nice. Mm-hmm. And it was a good breather in that moment. And then the split open and melt really continued that trend of like these dark and evil, almost noisy jams that they've continued. I was at the one in Hampton too. And to be honest with you, it's taken me a little while to get used to this new kind of split open and melt, but it's certainly interesting, and it's really cool to see them push a song like that, you know, an older song, to these new levels.
And Matt, I want to get your take on this set, because I rarely like text with friends during a set, but I was texting with you during this. But I do want to say first, when they went into waiting, that I had to ask the people behind us to be quiet like two different times, and they were really they were really annoyed with the song choice. It's like one of my favorite Phish ballads, so I was happy to hear it, but they did not like being asked to be quiet multiple times. But you know, that's what we have to do as fans. Matt, what did you think of that? I guess the light jam or anything else from the second set?
Yeah, it seemed like this was the space set. Like the night before, maybe it was kind of dark and funky. The first set here was sort of the rarities and jam sandwiches. And then the second set on the 30th was very, very, very spaced out. I there was at least four or five different times throughout the set where I legitimately lost track of what song they were playing. Mm-hmm. I just could not figure it out, including the split open and melt. It got to a place where it just like almost just went into nothingness. And then just like they managed to bring it back to split open and melt. I think if people are dinging this set for anything, it's probably for the Waiting in the Velvet Sea and the fact that because it got so spacey, it was a little bit less energetic than some of the other sets, mm-hmm. Which I didn't mind. I like it when they go there. I was also feeling some of the fall vibes, particularly that first night of Hampton where things got really spacey a lot. And I like, if they're going to do something for a graceful landing out of some of that more psychedelic stuff, I think Waiting in the Velvet Sea is a really good choice for it. I always think back to like the version from the Paradiso in the Wormtown set.
Yeah.
How, like things just get so weird and then it just very delicately lands with this amazingly beautiful ballad. And that would have been cool. And I could understand at that point if they had ended there with people being a little upset with the end of the set, but then to play that amazing split open and melt afterwards, I thought was a really, really nice cherry on top. And then we got a super long encore, four song encore, which was pretty fun too.
Yeah, that encore was I was wondering what was going to happen there, but they just four songs without like not a combo that you see very, very frequently, but that's how it goes. So you guys were both there on the 31st, and I was intending to be asleep before the start of the first set. I was back home, but you guys were obviously there, and it seemed like the first set was sort of a little bit of a letdown maybe, but it may be actually kind of standard for a New Year's Eve show when there's so much anticipation and music to come. Dan, what was your take on that first set?
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. I mean, I know, you know, I think a prevailing 3.0 attitude is sort of try to go in with no expectations and just sort of enjoy it. And I feel like that's what I try to do as much as possible. But, you know, that said, it was New Year's Eve, Madison Square Garden, you know, it was probably the two of the better shows of the entire year on the 29th and 30th. So I had some expectations, obviously. And I would expect this set one like on the 28th, you know, to maybe open the run where they're trying to sort of find their footing and everything. But yeah, this was kind of an unmemorable set entirely. Obviously Waste was fun, and Trey swapped out guitars for that, and Antelope is always a fun set closer, but I was definitely hoping for a little bit more.
Matt, what about you?
Yeah, I was just thinking and realizing that I haven't listened to a note of either of these shows since they happened. Just in the travel back and work and everything today, I haven't managed to fire them up. So I was reading through the set list and kind of almost going like, oh wow, I forgot that they played half of these songs, which I guess isn't a good sign for the set. For better or for worse, I think we've all sort of been conditioned to go into the 31st thinking that overall it may not be like the most amazing show. And you kind of have to zero in on the gag, because that's pretty much where the band's heads are. They're thinking about that all night. And even if they start to get, make really good momentum going like they did in the next set with The Disease or anything like that, or the Seven Below, it quickly comes back to this thing that's looming above them. I will say, like, I thought, set one was fun as usual. It was cool that we got a couple more of the Castle Vox songs. I love Stray Dog, so I was pretty stoked to hear that. The other thing that I noticed was they always seem to love playing Lawn Boy whenever there's a New Year's gag that makes the stage bigger. I don't know if you could tell from the... where you people were sitting, particularly down low, or if you could tell from the webcast, but there was a whole like front extension onto the stage where the people would come out later to go up onto the nets. And Paige and Mike were just sort of, it was like teasing them, like they wanted to get out into this front part and take better advantage of being able to walk further and interact with the crowd. Mm-hmm. And I remember them doing that on some other years, like the Meat Stick and stuff, where they wound up with a bigger stage that night. It was pretty much what I think you expect from a set one in the 31st, pretty good song selection, but just building a lot of momentum for what's to come. The only other thing is, I think it was a pretty long set as far as New Year's set ones tend to go. It was mm-hmm. close to 90 minutes, which is a little bit longer than they have tended to do. But I think, for New Year's Eve, as long as it's a fun show and there's a good New Year's gag, I'm in for that.
Yeah, totally. And the second set, you mentioned the Down With Disease and the Seven Below, I thought were both really, really good, solid, surprisingly good jams. Dan, did you have any particular highlights from that set before we get into the third?
Yeah, so I thought Mike Gordon was just, I think he really took a lead in that set, and he was great in the Down With Disease jam. And he was really good in Seven Below too. There was a moment toward like the end of Seven Below where he just sort of took over, like almost from Trey, like playing like lead bass, I guess, for mm-hmm. lack of a better way to explain it. And that was really, really exciting. There was obviously that some stop start and some woos in there, I think. And I know that can have mixed responses and stuff. But the Seven Below jam, I thought overall was really solid. The twist was, I guess, fitting for the woo theme. I got to say, with regard to Harry Hood and the passing through Harry Hood sort of sandwich, I think that, as successful as the Tweezer, Death Don't Hurt Very Long Tweezer sandwich was the night before, this was not successful in my opinion. It's hard to argue with the Hood, but like putting Passing Through in the middle of that, it just didn't really make much sense. And they sort of had to start Hood up from like nothing sort of at the end there. And Hood was going to some really interesting places before they brought in the Passing Through. So that was a bit disappointing, but that wasn't my favorite sandwich, I guess.
Yeah. I don't want people to fuck with my Hoods either, but I don't know.
Yeah. It's funny because I said a second ago, I haven't re-listened to any of this, and you get those experiences at shows, and definitely my overall experience with this whole show was probably of this type, where like you have a really good time, and maybe even a lot of people you're talking to at the show or right after the show, your friends or whatever, everybody's got really, really positive things to say. And then of course the second that you fire up the internet, people are telling you that all of the things that you thought were amazing were actually terrible, including this show, because there was a lot of, I had a lot of discussions with people that night after the show. People were like, man, I felt like this was one of the strongest New Year's shows in a really long time. Like overall, like they kept the energy up and the gag was great and everything. And then got on the internet and of course people were saying pretty nasty things about it. But this Harry Hood segment was one of them, which I actually like, I felt like it was really, really good when I saw it. And then afterwards, everybody was like, no, it was so botched. And I was like, I must have just been a little bit too lost in my own thoughts during that, because I remember it being pretty cool. So I'll have to go back to the tapes later and learn how I was mistaken and how everybody else was right about that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's always the, like, that's always the challenge, right? It's like the shows you go to and the shows you listen to later. But I think this is... Well, once we get to the gag, I mean, this is a pretty solid overall show. Dan, what was your take on the gag and how that all came together?
I absolutely loved the gag. Leading up to it, there was some, foreshadowing set break music they were doing. I heard some Daft Punk. They did Beastie Boys, Intergalactic. And, I think unlike other years, it was at least somewhat obvious what was coming. I mean, I think everyone was excited for Santos, and Mercury sort of had a breakout year, and so I think that this was like a little bit more predictable than ones in the past. Unfortunately, I was kind of like the victim of my seat, this is going to sound kind of crazy because we had great seats. I was in section 104, which was obviously in the 100 level. It's kind of like the opposite side of the arena from where the stage is, kind of where it begins to bend. But it was you're far enough away where I couldn't tell from my seat that Trey was on the white Stratocaster, and Trey and Mike were wearing these like silvery outfits, and it was just kind of like a silver image, the outline. So I couldn't see that he was on the white Stratocaster for Mercury, but the Mercury was really good, and that was just a really great placement for the song. And the acrobats and the dancers and the whole Nets Are Unbreakable thing was just really, really cool. And, after Auld Lang Syne, you could hear Santos coming, and, that was really exciting. Especially because, with all the streamers and the balloons and everything, it got even harder to see the stage because, there's like essentially like the entire height of the garden, those silver streamers that were hanging from the top of the arena. And so like, I couldn't really see. And it wasn't until after the show we even realized that, Trey and Mike, were sort of flying through space during Santos.
Yeah. That was pretty cool to watch. I watched back the next morning. Matt, what's your take?
Well, so I was going to, I guess, I don't, did you watch the webcast at all while it was happening, RJ?
I didn't. I watched everything the next morning.
Okay.
I did watch the first set. I didn't see the second and third till the next day.
So yeah, because I know they just dropped the video a little while ago. So most of us probably haven't had a chance to rewatch. And I was wondering how it translated to the video because for some of the same reasons that Dan was just saying, I was in 104 on the 30th. So I know exactly the perspective you're coming from. I was closer to the stage, but up in the 200s the next night on New Year's Eve. So we had a different vantage point. I also could not see that they were wearing the silver suits or anything because for most of Mercury, Crota had the lighting rig down like right over the band. So we actually couldn't really see the band. They were kind of obscured by the lights, but it looked really cool. He did this thing where it's that effect everybody's seen throughout this whole year where the lights were hovering right over the band, but instead of pointing them down at the band, he pointed them up. So it looked like there was like a UFO hovering above them, which was really neat. But then when those streamers came down, we said the same thing. Like we had this viewpoint where we could, like, because of the way that they were kind of, if you can picture the ceiling of Madison Square Garden, like they came down through like the cracks in those the wedge pieces. And so we could see straight through two of the sets of streamers to the stage. But I kept thinking like, man, if we were sitting where we were last night, I wonder if we'd be able to see the stage at all, or if it would just be like a wall of silver. And a lot of them, maybe like 50% of them came down, people pulled on them and they came down. But the ones that didn't, that stayed up there for the rest of the set, looked amazing because when the light bounced off them, it just looked like there was these sort of dots floating in the air. that were really cool. As far as the, you know, the gag itself, I agree. I think, you know, pretty much most people expected Santos to be played before or after midnight, which was a great payoff. And Mercury has become such a fan favorite that I thought that was a really good choice too. The I'm the type of person that really gets into some of the more elaborate gags that they do. Like, for context, I loved the Petrichor thing. You know, I don't want to see them do that all the time, but once a year, if you're going to put on a huge production, I think that's to have the dancing and the flying props and the lights coordinated and everything is really neat. I think this year's was a little bit better compromise for people who like some interesting things going on, but are not so much into the more Broadway style stuff that they've done occasionally. Although I do think it's funny that this was a year where they had people flying and people seem to really, really like it. But the year that they did the same thing with Steam, everybody hated it. But I guess you got to fly to the right song.
Right.
But people that I talked to after the show who had not liked Petrichor and some of the other more elaborate ones really liked this. I think understated was a term I heard several times. It was a little bit more simple, straightforward, and a lot more fun. And then I think that, as I was kind of alluding to earlier, like, the general sentiment seemed to be that while they've whiffed it after the gag in set threes in recent years, this was actually a very, very strong set. After the Santos, like, no, or I guess the simple after the Santos, no major jams or anything like that, but good song selection, really high level of energy, you know, nothing that kind of took the audience out of it. So it seemed like they closed things out pretty strong.
Yeah, Dan, what was your take on that third set? Because I haven't actually listened past the simple, just because it looked like it was like, you know, a 6-minute Susie and a 7-minute whatever and whatever. I just haven't gone back to it. But yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that, Matt, that you think it was a strong sort of finish. Dan, did you get the same impression?
Yeah, I really did. And just to get back to Santos for one quick second, I mean, I think with all the Kasvat Voxt songs, most people like, you know, at least a few of the songs, it seems like Santos is the one that people like the most. I mean, I did the 4-night run with a friend of mine, named Ian, and he was sort of indifferent on Kasvat Voxt and, you know, sort of didn't know what to expect. And then I looked over, you know, during Santos, and he was dancing as hard and singing along, you know, as anybody in the place. And I think it converted, you know, any naysayer about that, just because, you know, that sort of moment in that release. And I thought that simple and saw it again, especially, to answer your question about what you're saying, really, you know, were great choices, like, just to continue that sort of high energy pace. And I completely agree with what you guys were saying too, that the end of this set and the song selection, yeah, there wasn't any big jams in there, but I couldn't have asked for you know, five better songs than Simple, Saw It Again, Limb by Limb, Rock and Roll, and Susie to end that set. I really loved that third set, and I really did love the gag.
So, Dan, thanks for being a guest on this. After doing the 4-night run, besides being exhausted, what are you, like, a takeaway or two from you on this run and maybe wrapping up Phish in 2018?
You know, I got to say, I was really pleased with the run overall. I think it ended up being 12 shows this year. I did 5 of the summer shows on the East Coast. I really thought Hampton was sort of a step above what I saw over the summer. And I thought the 29th and the 30th were as good as anything that I had heard this year. I really loved that tweezer on the 29th. I just thought that was kind of unexpected in that spot. And it was just so, so good. And the 30th, I thought, continuing with some of those themes and, you know, the bust outs and everything, it was just a really, really fun run. And those were the 29th and 30th and the gag were really special.
Awesome. That's great to hear. Matt, what's your take? And I don't want to put you on the spot, Matt, but do you think that this, as we wrap up 2018, that the kind of curveball fiasco is behind us and that this run and everything that happened in the fall was a little bit of a compensation for it? Or how do you think that balances out?
Yeah, you know, that's pretty much exactly what I was going to say. I mean, we've come back to it a couple times on the show, but I think it always helps to have patience and to trust in the long game when we're talking about all things Phish. And people in the aftermath of just a weird summer overall. When I was just thinking about it, it wasn't just curveball. It was curveball. It was the thing that happened at the Gorge with those guys getting attacked. It was just kind of mediocre playing at a lot of the shows in the summer. People were very reactionary and wanted some sort of payback from the band. They wanted them to make it up immediately, and people were asking for big things for them. And I think instead what they did is they did what they did best. I mean, throughout the fall and through this New Year's run, they delivered amazing shows with songs that people wanted to hear, tons of bust outs. I think this is one of the, for the last like 3 or 4 months, this has been one of the periods of following this band where I think they're directly reacting to like what the fans want in terms of big bust outs that they never thought would play, jamming Tube, more jams in the first sets of shows. And then when they saw the reaction to the Castle Vox set, kind of doubling down on that. I made a comment to my wife when I was walking away from the show the other day that I was really grateful that people that weren't in Vegas got to experience some of that with the gag and, you know, kind of a little bit of a Castle Vox reprise with playing all the songs, but then peaking in Santos at midnight. So I think they really, really followed through. I mean, if you want to use a sports analogy, this is like the equivalent of your team just really sucking up until the All-Star break and then following through and winning the World Series. So I think that they did a really, really great job. I also had this thought, you know, at the show the other night. I was getting a little sentimental because we took my brother-in-law, Dan, who I've mentioned on the show before. Hi to Uncle Dan.
Yeah.
We took him to his first show at the Garden. And I think we saw you the other night, RJ, and to be able to look at his face and see the look on his face, especially during that first set on the 30th, which was his first set of Phish or first set of anything ever inside the Garden, was just really amazing. And it reminds you of why we do all this. But as I was kind of taking that in, I had this thought that, you know, Trey in particular is this guy who looks up to all these, you know, legendary world famous composers and people who have done things in music that are celebrated over the matter of centuries and stuff like that. And thinking about them playing in that building so much, and it's like, for a guy who, you know, studied classical composition and all this stuff, but was also, you know, a student of Jimi Hendrix and Jimmy Page and Eric Clapton, all these people as rock stars, to be able to essentially present his work in this great rock hall, Madison Square Garden, over and over again. I hope it's something that, you know, decades and maybe even a century from now, people are looking back on and realizing, the home court advantage that these guys have playing there, and what a joy it is for everybody to really experience that. And I think it's particularly ever since the Baker's Dozen, when we all get together there, there's just this big hug that happens. That, you know, we know that the band's going to do great. The people working there love us. We love being there, and it's really something special. So if you have gotten a little bit jaded by all that, I recommend taking somebody you know to their first show there, and you can sort of relive the whole thing through their eyes.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. I like how you put that. It's interesting. I just want to add one thing. I was actually getting a little bit emotional during the first set of 12:30 also. Maybe it was the air in the room. But I was thinking about how infrequently I step back and think about how much the band has contributed to like my life and my friendships and all kinds of other stuff, you know, over the past 25 years or so. And at that moment, for some reason, during Mike's song, I was thinking about it and thinking about all the other almost 20,000 people in there who had similar experiences. And I think there is something different about that venue. And I was thinking back to previous MSG shows that I'd been to and the people I'd been with and all that. And that, I think maybe the venue itself also just kind of makes people, all of us as a community, feel closer, like you said, Matt. So that's cool, man. What an awesome way to close it out. So thanks for sharing that. Dan, thanks for joining us and for sharing your perspective and, you know, for supporting us and all that. So thank you.
Thank you guys for having me. It's fun.
Cool. And thanks, Matt. And we'll be back in a couple weeks, I think, with our first episode of 2019.
Yeah, Fish may take a break in the first half of the year, but we will not be. We'll keep it going strong. We've got some cool stuff coming up.
Yeah, absolutely. So thanks, everybody, for listening and for all your support. And let's have an awesome 2019 together. Keep on rocking.
Seconds, 29, 28, 27, 26.